Welcome to People's Video Audio, a series of talks by author and political analyst Michael Parenti. His books include Democracy for the Few, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. Today's talk is Executive Power and Democratic Needs, the National Security Gangster State in the Clinton Era. It was given in Sebastopol, California, March 1994. Here's Michael Parenti.
There has been, as you know, in modern times, a massive growth of government. Government has grown immensely. And there are two theories to explain that. One is the conservative view, which is that government grows because bureaucrats are given to self-aggrandizement and professional elites just like to create services and agencies to advance their careers. That's one view. And also because of those power-wielding, selfish, greed-driven welfare mothers who cause so much growth in government and spending. There's another theory which has a closer relationship to reality. And the second theory is the political-economic theory. That is that government grows because the population grows and the economy grows. And that government growth came mostly at the behest of those very dominant conservative interests that are always bemoaning the growth of government. As the economy grew from a colonial, self-sustained, local, self-employed economy to a complex, mass-market, corporate capitalist economy, you had what? You had the need for new modes of transportation and whole new technologies developed by government. You had export supports and market protections that came from the government. You had price supports and investment subsidies that came from the government. Now, the cobbler, the smith, the housewife, the seamstress, they didn't demand these services and growths, and they weren't for their benefit. They were there for the people who owned and controlled the land, the labor, and the resources. What is this federal bureaucracy that the conservatives and the business community rail against? Well, you look at it. The Department of Commerce, the Department of Transportation, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Treasury, the Department of Agriculture, which is mostly for agribusiness, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Energy, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Federal Reserve System, which is banker-dominated, who sell at the cost of $300 billion a year to the U.S. taxpayer, who sell us our dollars, our currency. The United States doesn't have a currency. Just look into your wallet next time. You will not see. It's not a U.S. currency. It's a Federal Reserve currency. Now, in almost all these instances, the government units came into existence, as I said, at the behest of the business community because it had different kinds of service needs and regulatory needs. And the biggest bureaucracy of all, the biggest bureaucracy, which you can take almost all the other ones and stick in that one, it's called the Department of Defense. And that reminds us that along with the growth of government has come the growth of the state. And I make that distinction between government and state because the state is a particular thing. The state is not the mediator and creator of policy as such. It is the purveyor of force and control. As Max Weber, the German sociologist, bourgeois theorist, anti-Marxist, said, the state has a monopoly of the legitimate or legal uses of force and violence. It is the purveyor. It is the protector of the status quo of law and order. The difference between government and state is the difference between the city council and the police. You get it? It's the difference between the Congress and the CIA. It's a theoretical distinction about empirically overlapping actualities. I say that especially, for instance, in regard to the executive, where we don't distinguish state functions and policy functions. We have the president who does all those things. And so the executive is at the center of government policy and is also at the center. The chief executive is the purveyor of state power and force and violence. And so with the courts and certain administrative agencies, they sort of do some of both, and to a lesser extent, even security forces and police. And even elements in Congress which deal principally with governance and policy, even there are elements in there that are part of the national security state, people in the Senate Intelligence Community and others. A guy like Sam Nunn, after all, fulfills state functions. He's on cue. North Korea, we got to hit him. He's out there giving the hard line on North Korea. And so it is. The state has two basic purposes. The primary function is social and class control, to protect the haves from the have-nots, to maintain the security of those who accumulate wealth from the labor of others, to protect wealth from the poverty that wealth creates, to make sure that there's no reversal in the continual upward distribution of earnings and income from the people who work for wages and salaries to the people who live off dividends and interest and land and mineral royalties and rents, to safeguard against any fundamental reform or revolutionary reversal in regard to which class controls the land, the labor, the markets, and the natural resources in this country and abroad. Well, isn't that just a lot of your Marxist ideology again? We've got to hear this sort of stuff. That's not ideology, that's a fact. And then, by the way, we're not... Marx was not the first to say that. All the bourgeois theorists said it. 1689, John Locke. I mean, he is the theorist of the rising bourgeoisie, the glorious revolution of 1688 in Britain. He is the theorist. John Locke, quote, in his second treatise on civil government, "The great and chief end of men's uniting into commonwealths and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property." Adam Smith, 1776, quote, "The necessity of civil government grows up with the acquisition of valuable property." Smith goes on, "Till there be property, there can be no government, the very end of which is to secure wealth and to defend the rich from the poor." Now, if I had quoted that and not said who it was, there are all sorts of people who have said, "That's Marx, isn't it? That's Marx." No, that was Adam Smith. That was one of your boys who said that back when they used to be more frank and candid about this, because they were only talking to each other at the time. The rest of us didn't go to school and couldn't read, so they could be more honest and say this to each other, what they really were doing. The state also has a secondary function. That secondary function is public safety and justice, but it's a secondary function. Oh, come on, you're saying that these purveyors of state power would put their wealth and property interests ahead of human life? Did I say that? Well, yeah, that's right. Yes. But I didn't say that. Again, it's not just Carlo Marx. It's not just me. J. Edgar Hoover said it. He said, I quote, "The function of law, the purpose of law," and by that he means state power, what he represented, "the purpose of law is order, not justice. Justice is only an incidental or secondary consideration." I love it when they say it, you know, they say it. You're beautiful, J. Edgar. He came out of the closet on that one anyway. When this second function sometimes gets in way of the first function, when considerations of public safety and justice get in the way of considerations of power and defending wealth and class privilege, then the second function proves to be very, very dispensable, very disposable indeed. When the state decides it must develop nuclear instruments of death to maintain state power in order to maximize its power to perform its primary function to keep control over other forces throughout the world and show itself the primary nuclear power so no one will mess with the Fortune 500. It will sacrifice the second function, the public safety of citizens in Utah who live downwind. It'll poison those people. It'll lie to them what it's doing. When the state has to test its troops and its reliability, when there's nuts in Washington, those nuts are considering back in 1947 and 48 the possibility of launching a nuclear war against the Soviet Union then, and they were worried whether troops would walk across hot ground after a nuclear attack, And they put out tens of thousands of those guys out there in trenches and then had them walk across zero ground and saying, well, we didn't know about the radiation. If you didn't know about the radiation, why were the brass 2 miles back in lead-lined observation posts looking through little goggles? They knew back then how bad and horrible those weapons were. They knew back then. They had plenty of scientific information. They knew about the women who'd been working in factories in the 1920s and 30s, painting radium on wristwatches and moistening the brushes with their lips and dying from awful cases of cancer. They had stuff. They knew this stuff already. Norman Bradbury, I just saw him on TV. You know, every 3 or 4 years or so, ABC has a show that's worth watching. And there was one just the other night. He was the official who headed up one of the operations. And they had the downwinders, these people in Utah, all of them good Republicans. I mean, killing their own, you know. They consciously picked Utah because the Mormons believe that the United States is a sacredly endowed government, and the U.S. Constitution is, and they're faithful and loyal. Those would be the least to complain. They'd even wait for the winds to shift. If the winds were heading toward Vegas, they'd wait till the shift to Utah, because they get less trouble from Utah. Vegas, they have some of their own friends and associates there. Other mafiosa just like them, you see. So the winds go down there, and Norman Bradbury was on last night, and he said it was worth putting a few thousand at risk to save millions, what we had to do. He actually argued both sides of the street. He said he wasn't consulted about the fallout risks. Then his former daughter-in-law came on the screen, and she was just a child then, and she said, Norman Bradbury, my father-in-law, came down and told us to leave. He told his son and me and others to get out. It's not going to be safe. So he knew he was willing to risk lives, but not his own and not those of his family. He's willing to risk your life. That's the national security state in action, the gangster state that parades around as the defender of democracy. Within the government, there exists what some have called the national security state. It's not a formal organization as such. It consists of the president, the secretaries of state and defense, the National Security Council, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and numerous intelligence agencies. By the way, it consists of those if they're operating in the right class and power direction. When Kennedy was making noises and was toying with a soft policy toward Cuba, it's very interesting. Robert Murrow wrote about this in his book, First Hand Knowledge. Robert Murrow was a Republican, right-wing businessman who wrote a book, told how he was a CIA operative and was in on the Kennedy assassination. He got the Manlike Carbone guns and actually gave them out and didn't know what he was doing. Later on, he realized the role he had played and was very surprised how the CIA was in operation with mafia elements and all that. It was kind of unsettling for this nice, you know, white Protestant Republican guy to find this out about the CIA. And what's interesting is that when the CIA had troubles with Kennedy, then Kennedy was no longer quite in that inner circle. They actually withheld information from the president. So those agencies, those operations of state, will withhold information even from other elements within that national security state if they begin to find them unreliable. And when Kennedy appointed McCone and got rid of Dulles, they withheld information from the director of the CIA himself. So it really depends on which political ideological direction you go in. These things are very flexible and very operational in a way. The national security state often operates like an unaccountable sovereign power of its own. None of these people said, not once, read this whole book, not once does he quote anybody getting up and saying, the Constitution says the president is endowed with sovereign power because he's elected by the people, so maybe we should tell him this. Not, I mean, anybody who said that, he'd probably end up, you know, dying of natural causes. The primary function of the national security state is to defeat anti-capitalist forces at home and abroad, or movements that try to introduce any economically redistributive politics, even within the existing capitalist framework in any kind of fundamental reformist way. Making the world safe for free market capitalism is a massive enterprise. Security agencies expend about 40 to 50 billion a year on operations at home and abroad, probably more. Congress has no exact idea how much it is because it's hidden in the Pentagon budget and other places. The total figure is a secret, which is, by the way, in violation of the U.S. Constitution, which says that all receipts and expenditures and appropriations must be public knowledge. Along with the CIA and the National Security Agency, the National Security Agency monitors, breaks codes, and monitors all telephone calls and telegrams between the United States and every other country, and a great deal of domestic telephone traffic. They now have these super monitor systems that they could do this. They have certain code words. They can bust right into your conversation if you say something like you're talking to someone. You say, CIA, boop, it could pop off, and then you might be listened to. There's also the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, which deals with military espionage and counterintelligence around the world. The State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the FBI's counterintelligence program. Within the Pentagon itself, each echelon, be it the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Army, Secretary of Navy, or the Air Force, all have their intelligence units. The regional commands around the globe, and even the smaller units within the regional commands, each of them has its own intelligence service with its own security, communications, and support services. Supposedly protecting us from foreign threats, these agencies spend a great deal of time policing and propagating views among the U.S. public itself. At one time or another, they've admitted to maintaining surveillance on members of Congress, on the White House, on the Treasury and Commerce Departments, and on vast numbers of private citizens. They plant stories in the U.S. media to support their Cold War and counterinsurgency view of the world. They get journalists to work as operatives for them. They get operatives to work as journalists. Senator Church Committee found 500 journalists and editors and publishers, including most of the Copley publications, some people in Gannett, Ben Bradley, Washington Post, or CIA, bunches of them, CIA. The CIA alone has subsidized the publication of hundreds of books and has owned outright more than 200 wire services, newspapers, magazines, book publishing complexes, according to a Senate Intelligence Committee report. It's recruited some 5,000 academics from across the country as spies and researchers, secretly financing and censoring their work while they parade as independent scholars. I remember once at Yale, when I was back for a postdoctoral fellow, and I was getting very, very active in the anti-war movement, was out there, and an esteemed member of that department coming over to me. I mean, the guy had his bags, his travel bags, right there. And he's saying, "I think you're losing your objectivity as an academic." He had his travel bags. He was heading down to Washington. He consulted on State Department policy in Vietnam. He didn't see that as losing his objectivity. He saw that as lending his expertise to policy formation. But I was an interested ideologue, you see. I was getting ideological, telling me, because I was opposing the war. These guys who were supporting the war were being scholars. So the CIA scholars attend academic conferences. The CIA agents, the agency conducts its own resident scholar programs. CIA scholar is, I believe, an oxymoron. The CIA offers internships and tuition assistance to undergraduate and graduate students while they're still attending school. Intelligence agencies have infiltrated and financed student, labor, scientific, and peace groups. They have financed research on mind control, drugs, and all the like. All of this in violation of the National Security Act. In violation of the National Security Act of 1947, which states that the CIA, quote, shall have no police, subpoena, law enforcement, or internal security functions. In fact, the CIA has equipped and trained local police forces in the United States. For what? For what goals? How many Russian invaders was the Detroit police going to face. What was the goal? The goal was domestic counterinsurgency, the goal that's going on even to this day, the goal of infiltrating peace groups, getting troublemakers in those groups, stealing the mailing lists. The goal is making sure the black gangs fight each other, the Crips versus the Bloods. The goal is to get those Crip leaders who have brought peace between the gangs and railroad them into jail, as Dwayne Holmes has gone to jail. My son Christian Parenti just did an article on that in Z Magazine a couple of issues back, and arguing that, in fact, crime is very functional as an instrument of class control. That's Christian's thesis. He says that crime, after all, does not affect the people who live in Grosse Pointe or Bel Air or wherever else. That crime affects the people who live there. And they'd much rather see a disorganized, demoralized inner city population than one that's developing leadership and organization and moving and asking for redistribution of the goods and services of society. Blackstone Rangers back in the 60s used to say, when we were stealing cars and shooting up and breaking into stores and hitting each other with guns, we had less trouble from the police than when we made a truce and we started looking at social issues. That's why the day I heard about the alliance between the Crips and the Bloods, I announced that the police will now move in on these guys and do everything they can to break them up. Police leaders in L.A. say, we've never taken this truce seriously. They don't want to take it seriously. Well, that's a very nice, positive, encouraging way to look at things. Well, their goal, the goal of the Red Squads, is to carry on this system of surveillance and counterinsurgency. A lot of those functions have been taken out of the FBI because of all the controversy and all that, and it's been given to the local Red Squads. Most of the time when you think your phone is being tapped by the FBI, it's being tapped by some copper. The crimes that are perpetrated by the national security state against the people of other nations are too numerous to detail. In countries like Guatemala, El Salvador, Greece, Brazil, Chile, Panama, Grenada, Iraq, Indonesia, East Timor, Argentina, Haiti, Zaire, the Philippines, the CIA, or sometimes U.S. Armed Forces, other national security state forces, or sometimes they use mercenary forces, whatever, use military intervention, terror, assassination, sabotage, bribery, propaganda, political disruption to bring down populist or democratically elected governments and install reactionary dictatorships that are friendly to U.S. corporate interests. And that is the criteria. You can be a murderer, you can be a butcher, you can suppress people's rights, you can do whatever you want, as long as you keep your country open to the capital investment of the corporate 500. You could be democratic, you could have elections, you could have all those things, as Gorbachev was doing in 1989, and the insistence, the bombardment we got from the media, when will he complete the reforms? When will he do the reforms? Because the real reforms have nothing to do with democracy and everything to do with capitalism. The CIA has sabotaged and stolen elections abroad, waged massive disinformation campaigns, infiltrated and fractured the trade union movements of other nations. It's funded and trained secret armies, paramilitary forces, torture squads, death squads, and pursued destabilization and assassination campaigns against labor, peasant, clergy, and student organizations in numerous countries. I was telling you about Murrow observing the CIA's links with the mafia. Well, U.S. intelligence agencies have used mobsters, drug dealers, and warlords in their war against those who are anti-capitalist, those who resist the encroachments of global corporatism. The CIA supplied arms and money to the Italian and Corsican mafias to break and murder members of the communist-led dock workers' unions in Italy and southern France. After these unions were broken, the mobsters were given a freer hand in transporting tons of heroin each year from Asia to Western Europe and North America. They, in fact, controlled the waterfronts after that. The CIA buttressed anti-communist warlords in Southeast Asia and Afghanistan, whose opium production increased tenfold soon after the agency moved into those regions. CIA involvement in Central America contributed to the U.S. cocaine epidemic of the 1980s. CIA planes transported guns and supplies down to right-wing mercenary troops in Nicaragua and pro-capitalist military leaders in other countries. The planes then were reloaded with narcotics for the return trip to the United States. Ralph McGehee. Don't take my word for it. Listen to Ralph McGehee. He was a CIA officer. A CIA officer for 25 years. Quote, my view, backed by 25 years of experience, is, quite simply, that the CIA is the covert action arm of the presidency. Most of its money, manpower, and energy go into covert operations that include backing dictators and overthrowing democratically elected governments. The CIA uses disinformation, much of it aimed at the U.S. public, to mold opinion. McGehee goes on. But if the agency actually reported the truth about the Third World, what would it say? It would say that the United States installs foreign leaders, arms their armies, and empowers their police to help those leaders repress an angry, defiant people. That the CIA-empowered leaders represent only a small fraction who kill, torture, and impoverish their own people to maintain their position of privilege. Instead, the agency plants weapons shipments, forges documents, broadcasts false propaganda, and transforms reality. Thus, it creates a new reality that it then believes. Now, the thing you can say about Bill Clinton is that he's perfectly at home with all of this. He has not uttered a word about reining in the CIA. He's not uttered a word about, not intelligence. They always then argue, they would say, well, you need these agencies to keep an eye on things, to find out we're in the world of everything. We're not talking about intelligence gathering. We're talking about covert action. We're talking about murder. We're talking about lawless, horrible disruption of any social formation that tries to do something for its people. You know, I like and admire Martin Luther King. But Martin Luther King said that the rich are heartlessly indifferent to the poor. And I have to disagree. Rich individuals may be, but the agencies of the rich are not at all indifferent to the poor. They very consciously propagate the conditions of poverty, of want, of disorganization and demoralization. They very consciously propagate those things. Any dollar I got to give to you as a worker is one less dollar that goes to me. If I can keep you hungry, if I can keep you working, working, working for less, working more, working harder for less, that's better for me. That's what's been happening in this country over these last 12 years. There's been a shift in the gross national income. In the lowest third have seen their income shrink by 10%, whereas the upper 5% has seen their income grow by 30%. It's not true that these are hard economic times. These are very good economic times for the people who have money. In 1930, at the depth of the Depression, Henry Ford made $30 million in profit. That was 1930, when $30 million could buy something, you know. And he said, depressions aren't all that bad. Bill Clinton has not uttered a word about reining in the CIA. The last president who did got blown away in Dallas. Bill Clinton is a member of the Council for Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Conference, which he attended with David Rockefeller when he was governor of Arkansas. Bill Clinton has proposed an increase in the CIA budget and the counterinsurgency budget. Bill Clinton proposed an increase in the defense budget. He's proposing more than Bush did. In his State of the Union message, he said, defense will not be cut. We need it for a safe world and for jobs, he said. For jobs, you see. Defense spending for jobs. That's an interesting idea. I mean, pornography creates jobs. Prostitution has jobs. Drug dealing has jobs of a sort. Couldn't you think of better jobs, Mr. President?
You are listening to author and political analyst Michael Parenti on executive power and democratic needs. At the end of the program, there will be information on how to obtain a copy of this talk.
The authors of American government textbooks like to point out that the president plays many roles. He has many roles. He's not only chief executive, we hear, but he's also the leader of his party. He's a chief legislator in the sense that he proposes a legislative program. He's in the policy process. And he's also commander-in-chief. And he's also the head of state, the way sort of the Queen of England is, you see. He's an embodiment. When I wrote my American government textbook, Democracy for the Few, was a sort of anti-textbook, actually, I said, there's another role that he has, which none of these other books have mentioned. He's the guardian and representative of capitalism. He's the embodiment of the executive-centered state system that defends American corporate interests at home and abroad. I'm quoting from one of my favorite authors right now, as a matter of fact. Every modern president has had occasion to praise the free enterprise system and denounce collectivist alternatives. William Shannon's description of President Ford, back when William Shannon used to criticize conservatism, President Ford, it could easily apply to any number of other presidents, quote, he follows the judgment of the major international oil companies on oil problems in the same way that he amiably heeds the advice of other big businesses on the problems that interest them. He is a solid believer in the business ideology of rugged individualism, free markets, and price competition, virtues that exist more clearly in his mind than they do in the practices of the international oil industry. Unquote. The president is, I maintain, the top salesman of the system. He conjures up reassuring images about the State of the Union. Nixon, America is number one. Reagan, America is standing tall. America is the greatest. This is what Ronald Reagan was saying to a nation with 35 million citizens living below the poverty level, millions unemployed, hundreds of thousands homeless, a record trade deficit, and a runaway national debt. Whether Democratic or Republican, liberal or conservative, the president tends to treat capitalist interests as synonymous with the nation's well-being. Presidents greet the accumulation of wealth as a manifestation of a healthy national economy, regardless of how that wealth is applied or distributed or what's it being used for. I mean, what's this wealth being used for? Is it being used to make more yachts? Or is it being used for housing for working people? Ronald Reagan, quote, America will achieve new heights spurred on by freedom and the profit motive. Ronald Reagan, I want America always to be a country where someone can become a millionaire. Ronald Clinton. Ronald Clinton on the McNeil Lair. Quote, this is a free enterprise country, said President Clinton. I want to create more millionaires in my presidency than Bush and Quayle did. What an ambition. What a goal. He didn't say that during the campaign. During the campaign, he was Jesse Jackson. When he got into office and started setting up, he was Jimmy Carter. Now he's Ronald Reagan. Now he wants to outdo Bush and Quayle. Presidents describe the overseas investments of giant corporations as U.S. interests. Those giant interests are called U.S. interests abroad to be defended at all costs, certainly at great cost to the U.S. populace. A president's primary commitment abroad is not to democracy, but to free market capitalism. And they are beginning to say that a little more candidly. You know, one seldom heard capitalism, the word, in the capitalist's own media that we live under. For decades, we were told that the Cold War was a contest between freedom and communism. No reference was made to the interests of global capitalism. But with the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, U.S. leaders and news media began to intimate that there was something more than just free elections and a free press, as they define it, on their agenda for those former communist nations. Namely, that something else was free markets. And this, as I said before, came out very clearly in 1989-90. When Mikhail Gorbachev had set up free elections, 15 political parties were running, opened the major media to all political persuasions, and all this sort of thing was going on, and the U.S. media was saying, yes, But will he complete the reforms? Will he extend the reforms? Will he stop before he gets to the reforms? And they kept saying, what are those reforms? The reforms were, was he going to get rid of socialism? So it wasn't that they were concerned about democracy. And they wouldn't give them any aid. We won't give you any aid until you get rid of socialism, until you privatize your economy, because that's our concern. We don't care if you have elections or you don't have elections. We don't care if you're a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, like in Guatemala, who we give a lot of support to, or Indonesia, or Haiti. What we care about is if you make the world safe for the people of our class. That is our state function, our international function. We use that word democracy for the folks out here. But if you give us democracy without capitalism, you're unacceptable. If you give us capitalism without democracy, you are acceptable. They saying that. They were saying that. They publicly acknowledged that a goal of U.S. policy was to install capitalism in the former nations. The propaganda task now was to treat capitalism as inseparable from democracy, always using the two terms, sandwiching them together, ignoring the many undemocratic capitalist regimes from Guatemala to Indonesia to Zaire. But capitalism still sounded a little too, too capitalist. So instead of that word, they used the preferred term, free market. See, which is kind of more inclusive, free market. We've all been to a market, see? It includes something more than just the capitalists and the Fortune 500. So they're fighting for free markets. They're going to take us to the market. They're going to take us to the cleaners. That's where they're going to take us. Don't believe me? Take President Clinton, September 27, 93, before the UN. Our overriding purpose. Did you hear those words? Our overriding purpose. What I said was the primary function of the state. Same word, same meaning. Our overriding purpose is to expand and strengthen the world's community of market-based democracies. And if they aren't democracies, as long as they're market-based. I'm adding that little footnote. In a similar vein, the New York Times noted, quote, Mr. Yeltsin remains the best hope for democracy, and then really warming to their subject, and a market economy in Russia. It's probably not easy for a president to remain keenly aware of the suffering and the travails and the deprivations endured by the great mass of people throughout the world, including a lot of ordinary working people in this country. I mean, the president lives like a monarch, a potentate in utter opulence. He lives in a rent-free 132-room mansion called the White House, set on an 18-acre estate with a personal domestic staff of about 100 people, including 7 butlers and 5 full-time florists, a well-stocked wine cellar, tennis courts, a private movie room, a private gymnasium, a private bowling alley. Lyndon Johnson must have put that one in. And a heated outdoor swimming pool. And this is a guy who's got to pose as a man of the people, who's concerned about ordinary folk. In addition, the president has the free services of a private physician, including all those presidents who didn't want people to have health insurance and socialized medicine, and that would be too much and all that. They should pay for their own medical care. They all had free medical care themselves. See, it's different when you have it for yourself. You understand? It's different. That's what Norman Bradbury is pointing out. It's you out there sacrificing for the country, but I get my family out from downwind. You preach one thing out there, and you do something else. The president also has a dozen chauffeured limousines, numerous helicopters and jets, including Air Force One, and he has access to the imperial luxuries of Camp David and other country retreats, free vacations, a huge expense allowance, and then for those very few things he must pay for out of his own pocket, he gets a salary of $200,000 a year. journalists and political scientists used to like to write, it was a real fad back in the late 50s, early 60s, used to describe the presidency as a man-killing job. Well, you know, closer investigation shows that presidents actually probably work a shorter day than the average working man or woman who really has to put in hours. That presidents take more vacations and they live far better and longer than the average American male, including the average middle-class white male. And after leaving office, by the way, they continue to feed off the public trough. 5 ex-presidents we have now, all of them multimillionaires, yet each one receives from $500,000 to $700,000 in annual pensions, office space, staff, and travel expenses, along with full-time Secret Service protection that costs $5 million for each of them. I mean, $5 million for Gerry Ford? Through the 1940s to the mid-60s, various liberals and political scientists argued that the presidency wasn't strong enough. When they saw FDR and Truman in tugs of war with Congress, they said not only is the president not strong enough, but the president is more virtuous than Congress, because the president, elected by all the people, represents the national interest, whereas Congress is riddled with entrenched special interests. See, they weren't allowed to talk in class power terms, so they had to make up these special kinds of terms. What they really meant was that Congress was more responsive to the organized moneyed interests and property corporate class, and the president was at least sometimes responsive to the working populace. Harry Truman used to say, Congress represents about 15 to 20% of the people. It's up to the president to represent the other 80, 85%. Which he really didn't do with the consistency that he pretended he did. So liberals call for the item veto. They call for limitless presidential terms. They oppose the 22nd Amendment. They call for less interference by congressional investigations. And conservatives were the opposite. They opposed the item veto, and they supported the 22nd Amendment. In fact, they put the 22nd Amendment through, which limited the number of terms a president can serve to 2. From the late 1960s through the 80s, both of these sides reversed their positions. First of all, the Electoral College has a stacked advantage for the GOP. You have all those small states out west, the Idahos, Dakotas, whatever, Nebraskas, and they all have that extra 2 electoral votes. You have number of representatives plus your 2 senators. That's your Electoral College count. So they have disproportionately much more than, say, big industrial states that might go liberal once in a while. Second, there was the breakup of the Southern Alliance with the Northern Democracy, and the South started going Republican. So suddenly you had what looked like a built-in advantage for the GOP, and you had an array of Republican and conservative presidents. Now, in addition to this, Congress started looking more liberal. For the first time, you had liberals occupying committee chair positions. People like Ted Weiss, John Conyers, Tom Harkins, Ron Dellums were getting into chair positions and wielding a little extra influence. And the Congress remained Democratic through thick and thin. So now you had the opposite. Liberals began complaining of an imperial presidency. And conservatives talked about, Norman Podaric just wrote an article on that called Imperial Congress, an out-of-control Congress. Now conservatives wanted an item veto. They denounced the 22nd Amendment. Most vehemently was Ronald Reagan as he was leaving office. I wrote him a letter when he was leaving office. Never answered it. I said, it was a very short note. I said, Dear Mr. President, I love the 22nd Amendment. Term limitations. Now the conservatives are calling for term limitations on Congress. They call for term limitations on state legislatures where the legislatures have Democratic leadership. And unfortunately, there are some people on the left who even went along with the term limitations, foolishly thinking that they were taking a swipe at the politicians. What the term limitations do is it wipes out the liberal leadership, it wipes out the liberal seniority, and it creates an amateur Congress that will always be made up of freshmen and sophomores who are just, it takes a year or more, 2 years to even learn the ropes, what's happening against a entrenched national security state, against an entrenched judiciary. The conservatives, you notice, have never called for term limitations for federal judges. Instead, they've appointed over 450 in the last two administrations. All young right-wing ideologues in their 30s and 40s who will be handing down decisions into the third decade of the next century. They stacked the court, and this time they did it systematically and knew how to do it in a way that Nixon never did. Well, is the president too powerful or not powerful enough? Actually, I think both the liberals and conservatives are consistent in both those inconsistent charges. Presidents are not powerful enough when working with mass interests, working for mass interests, I should say, and opposing corporate and financial interests. But the president is very powerful when engaging in the converse, when he's working for corporate interests and when he's working against mass interests. The president is very powerful when he's exercising state power. That whole theory, by the way, when liberals started talking about the imperial presidency, the Republicans hadn't gotten elected yet. There wasn't any Nixon or Ford or Reagan in yet. They were already talking about LBJ, and they were talking about Vietnam. And it occurs to them how irresponsive, unaccountable this power was, as millions of people were saying, get out of this war. And this war, these guys were still going ahead and doing it. And they're saying, my God, this president is an autocrat in a way. Well, on certain kinds of issues, and the closer he is to the state, he is. By the way, that same problem is true in Congress. I used to hear back in the old days that the third or fourth most powerful person in the military-industrial complex was the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Now we have a progressive who's chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and he says he's on edge, Ron Dellums, that he feels limited in what he can do or not do. And people are saying he's selling out. No, because most of his committee would probably oust him if he moved too far. Because the Pentagon doesn't want him. Because there are mass industrial powerful interests that can buy half of Congress and have bought half of Congress. And if Ron Dellums moved too hard and too fast against them, he would be out. He suddenly understands that the power of that office was not imbued in the office. The power of that office was there as long as that office served powerful interests. By the way, this is true of Clinton also, what I've just said. What you have here is a structuralist argument. This is this argument of the structuralist versus the functionalist. The structuralists say that the system prefigures what the people can do who go into it. And the functionalists say, no, the people who go in can make a difference. And it's all the question of which guy's in there. Is it a good guy or a bad guy? If it's a good guy, we'll get good policy. If it's a bad guy, we'll get bad policy. The structuralist says that regardless whether it's Tory or Labor, there must still be basic concessions and provisions to those who control the jobs, investments, and market forces, who control the other levers of the state. The structuralist argument is essentially correct, but it's over-applied. Because it's one thing to say that the structure is an inescapable overriding social formation that sets fundamental limits, and it's another thing to say that the structure predetermines all policy outcomes all the time. You can't say that. You get too abstracted, too mystical. I mean, Reagan and Thatcher demonstrated that it does make a difference who's elected. So the functionalists do have a point. That within certain parameters, it does make a difference who's on the Supreme Court, who staffs the departments, who makes decisions in the regulatory agencies and in Congress. It does make a difference. It determines what laws are passed and how they're enforced or how they're ignored. Bill Clinton is like every other president, a two-faced, a liar, and a deceiver. Now, this is not a personality peculiarity to the people who happen to go into that office. These presidents are two-faced because they must face contradictory forces, because the office itself is built with contradictions, because the whole system is built with a basic contradiction, the contradiction between plutocracy, the interest and power of wealth, and democracy. Frederick Schumann, the historian, a half a century ago made the point, quote, "The politician is someone who gets votes from the poor and money from the rich on the promise he will protect each from the other. More often than not, he ends up protecting the rich from the poor at the expense of the poor. It's easier." At the same time, for the system to maintain its acceptability among the people, that is, its legitimacy, it must have credibility. To have credibility, it must maintain certain appearances. To To maintain those appearances, it sometimes does have to make concessions. The need to maintain those appearances to keep credibility and keep popular support is the soft wedge in which popular forces can sometimes push and make gains. And this is why you had Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, all delivering a liberalish kind of rhetoric on some issues like the needs of the people, the environment. I mean, George Bush called himself the education president, the environment president, and yet they came out with conservative policies that have often violated that. The courage to change was the campaign theme that got Bill Clinton elected president in 1992. He promised labor law reform, but after more than a year in office, he's done nothing to liberate workers from restrictive organizing rules and one-sided enforcement procedures. Most U.S. workers, most working people in America want labor unions. They may have certain criticisms and all that. They've heard about this or that and the other thing. They do want unions because they know they are better off with a union than without a union. They at least have some kind of collective bargaining. They'll be working under a contract, whatever else. But it's too difficult. The laws are so rigged. They're so prohibitive under Taft-Hartley. And that's why labor unions are declining. It's not because people don't want them. It's because they're getting cut out. It's almost impossible. Unions cannot even go now onto the parking lots of a company to hand out literature to let them know that there's going to be a certification election coming up. The things that have been going on are tremendous. And these are things, by the way, which the media never report. Bill Clinton talked about helping the economically deprived, and yet he's failed to restore the human service cuts imposed by Reagan and Bush, including the 30% reduction in summer jobs for low-income youth. In fact, he himself has gone on to propose nearly 50% cuts in low-income housing aid. When his modest $19 billion economic stimulus package was stalled in the Senate, he let it die without a fight. He reassured the middle class that some of the unfair tax burden would be shifted back onto the rich. Then he proposed a 3% increase in the upper brackets. That's a crushing change. This is a bracket that has just enjoyed a almost 50% decrease during the Reagan-Bush years, from 70% down to 28%, that a 40% or so, a little over. Now it's up to 30. Then it went up to 31. And then, what is it now? 36, I think, is the max. He vowed to protect the environment, then backed a plan to open ancient forest reserves to timber operations and soften payments by oil spill polluters. In foreign affairs, Clinton has talked about charting a new course, but he's tread the same path. He bombed Iraq on a slender pretext, got to get his presidential blooding, got to kill a few, show that you're a real guy, you know? He continued Bush's armed intervention in Somalia, which is there not to feed the people, but to protect the immense oil deposits and oil concessions that have gone to four major American oil companies in Somalia. Three-quarters of the land has been conceded. He's done almost nothing to restore democracy in Haiti. He proposed a missile defense budget equal to the one that was accepted by Bush, despite the end of the Cold War, a nuclear missile defense budget. And the like, as I said, he increased the CIA, or he's maintaining it at its present ongoing level and all that. He's yet to fill hundreds of administrative posts. He's yet to fill over 100 judiciary posts, showing himself quite happy with the Reagan and Bush holdovers in many of these instances. The president has talked about the courage to change, but has not seemed interested in changing much of anything. So as I say, when he moves in a liberal direction, he's a weak president. When he moves in a conservative direction, he's a lion, as he was with NAFTA, where he bent arms and he did this and he did that. Another thing was he was tough on crime. Twice in his State of the Union message, he says, "I want a tough crime bill." What does that mean, tough? What does that mean? Nazi? Fascist? What does that mean? In a country where you got more prisoners per capita who are serving longer terms than any other industrialized country in the world, where the prison population in this country has grown faster than any other social population in the entire country. It's been skyrocketing. The one boom construction industry in this country at the depths of the recession was the building of prisons. What do you mean, tougher? Well, if you want to get tough, how about stop being so soft and wimpy on the corporate polluters, on the people who put in unsafe products? Well, instead, what Clinton gives us is repression, a tougher crime bill, and psychobabble. He He said, what we're suffering is a loss of values. We must change from within. Hey, where has he been visiting lately? He said, governments don't raise children, parents do. Yeah, but parents raise children in a social context. You think there's any parent that wants his or her kid to go out there and get shot up with guns or start dealing in drugs or this or that? You think the parents really want that? You think they can control? I mean, who brought those drugs in? People who live in desperate poverty are not the creators of the poverty, but its victims. Well, I'm going to stop here. I've been talking a long time. Let me just say that our task is to point out the obvious truth, that democracy and plutocracy are not one and the same, but they are polar opposites and deep contradictions. Our job is to inject as much dissension as possible and to keep them from inventing reality and inverting reality. Our job is to inject as much democratic content and democratic force into the democratic rhetoric. Thank you very much.
That was author and political analyst Michael Parenti speaking in Sebastopol, California, March 1994. You were listening to a talk on executive power and democratic needs. You can obtain a copy of this audio tape and others by Michael Parenti for $4 each from People's Video Audio in Seattle. For a free list of tapes, call People's Video Audio at area code 206-789-5371. That's area code 206-789-5371. Or write People's Video Audio at Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199. This is Sally Soriano for People's Video Audio. Thanks for listening.